Excellent. Well, thank you all for being here this afternoon. I'm very happy to be here. My name is Silas Allard. I'm the Associate Director at the Center for the Study of Law and Religion at Emory University, so a frequent partner, collaborator with the International Center for Law and Religion Studies here at Brigham Young University, so delighted for the invitation. No, I grew up in Missouri and had my Missouri accent trained out of me in 4 years of speech and debate in high school. And haven't picked up the Southern accent yet. So I'm going to be talking about what does the separation of church or religion and state really mean. So talking about the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. Now this is a big topic. There are a lot of different ways that we could approach this, and we could certainly spend more than the half an hour that I'm going to try and confine myself to so that we have time for discussion and questions. So a couple of parameters for the presentation today. What I will be covering is contemporary Supreme Court jurisprudence on the Establishment Clause, really beginning in 1947 with the Everson case, which marks the sort of beginning of modern Establishment Clause jurisprudence. And I'll be focusing, when we look at some of the particular issues later in the presentation, on religion in the public square. Religious displays, legislative prayers, religious access to public spaces, these sorts of issues. What I'm not going to cover today is historical understandings of the Establishment Clause, particularly the founding era understandings of the Establishment Clause. Fascinating conversation, not one that's really my forte and not one that I just have time to go into today, but I will give you some resources at the end of the presentation if that's something that you personally would like to explore more. I'm also not going to cover the particular situation of education because there are a couple of other breakouts, I think both yesterday and today, looking at education particularly. I will be referring to a number of cases that occur in the education context because a lot of the establishment law happens in the education context, but I'll be pulling from those cases for more general propositions, not thinking about them in the particular context of education. Schools are a unique environment, right? Both because they do formation and because the people in schools tend to be in the process of being formed. They're young. And so sometimes the particular context of education can shift the analysis a little bit. So to start off, I want to point to a tension that exists in the Establishment Clause jurisprudence. There are two sort of competing analytical frameworks that inform Establishment Clause jurisprudence, a separationist framework and an accommodationist framework. Now, these two tensions in the Establishment Clause have really been with us since the founding. There were founding members of the founding generation who really thought about establishment as an issue of separation, and there were others who thought about it as an issue of accommodation. For separationists, the prohibition on establishment of religion really means keeping religion and state as far apart as possible, right? Religion has its role in society, the state has its role in society, and they don't really have cross purposes or cross paths. So we should keep religious expression out of public space as much as possible, particularly out of government space. And government shouldn't really be supporting religion. The separationists worry that if you have a mingling of religion and state, then the state is eventually going to be controlling religion. And religion always runs the risk of turning the state's attention towards a particular sectarian agenda. So not really being government for all of the people. We see the separationist tendency in the Everson case in 1947 when the court writes that the wall of separation between church and state is high and impregnable, right? So that's the sort of strong separationist language. Accommodationists, on the other hand, view religion as a kind of necessary force in society. So the accommodationists are those who see religion as a space in which moral and civic virtue are developed, in which communal identity is formed. And because community, identity, morality are all necessary to the proper functioning of a nation, religion is necessary to the proper functioning of a nation. So the accommodationists are much more willing to allow religious expression in public spaces, and more willing to allow the government to support religion in achieving these ends. Accommodation has often come in two different flavors. On the one hand, you have kind of more civil religion, civic Republicans who think there should be a very generic kind of national religion that helps create these identities, and then those who think that this is best done by individual religious communities. But either way, they think that there's a role for religion in society and a role for the government in interacting with religion to promote those virtues. The accommodationist stance comes up in an early case in 1952, Zorach v. Clausen, in which the court essentially writes that religion is a long-standing, important, and necessary element of our civil society, and so government can't afford to simply exist in a hermetically sealed vacuum separate from religion. But the real watchword of modern Establishment Clause jurisprudence is neutrality, right? That the government should be neutral between religions and neutral between religion and non-religion. Now, you'll note that in my diagram, neutrality has its own little arrows, right? Because neutrality isn't a position that exists somewhere halfway between the separationists and the accommodationists. Neutrality is a framework, right? A guiding principle, but it can often be pulled in the direction of separationism or in the direction of accommodationism. You can have a kind of separationist neutrality or an accommodationist neutrality. The idea of neutrality is a modern guiding post for Establishment Clause jurisprudence begins with a case called Abington v. Shemp. In Abington, the court essentially says that what we are trying to do is develop a jurisprudence of wholesome neutrality. And the test for a jurisprudence of wholesome neutrality is that if a law either promotes or disproves religion, it is not valid under the Establishment Clause. A simple test in Abington: if something promotes or disproves religion, then it's not neutral, right? It is either for religion or it is against religion and fails this wholesome neutrality test. In two cases following Abington, Waltz v. Tax Commission and then Lemon v. Kurtzman, the court develops this test into a three-pronged neutrality test. So the court writes in Lemon, and eventually the test gets the name the Lemon test, which some of you may have heard in passing. To survive an Establishment Clause, a law must, one, have a secular purpose. It has to have a goal that is secular. Two, have a primary effect that neither advances nor inhibits religion. This is the sort of Abington neutrality principle, right? It neither promotes nor disproves, it neither advances nor inhibits religion in the effect that it has. And three, it fosters no excessive entanglement between religion and state. So the government, even if a law has a secular purpose, neither advances nor inhibits religion, if it requires the government to get all up in the business of religious communities, then there's too much entanglement. And we begin to worry about government takeover of religious communities. So these three principles become sort of the guiding, the more fleshed out guiding principles of neutrality following the Abington, Waltz, Lemon line of cases. But Lemon does not become, unfortunately, a clear and consistent guide to Establishment Clause jurisprudence thenceforth. Rather, Lemon, like neutrality generally, is subject to the pull of separation and accommodation. And so the court, responding to Lemon's inability to create a consistent jurisprudence, after a series of cases, these up here under the sort of neutrality banners, begins to develop and try other approaches. The court is not happy with the Lemon test, is not happy with the outcomes that it's generating, and so different justices, different iterations of the court are trying different things. We can sort of see how the Lemon test gets pulled in the direction of separation and accommodation when we look at the issues of neutrality. And I should say, by way of attribution, that this particular schematic of Establishment Clause jurisprudence is the product of my colleague John Witte and his co-author Joel Nichols in their book, Religion and the American Constitutional Experiment. So I cannot take credit for the beauty of this schematic. It's really their idea, but I think it's incredibly helpful. So I'm borrowing it for the presentation. So under Lemon, you basically get two lines of cases. One line of cases in which neutrality is exercised in a more separationist mold, or a strict neutrality, where equal treatment of religion and of religion and non-religion requires more government abstention from engagement with religion. So this includes the Lemon case itself. So in Lemon, the government actually denied a funding for religious, so for funding for secular education in religious schools because it failed the third test of Lemon. It created too much entanglement. In order for the government to kind of police secular funding for secular education in religious schools, it had to go in and be present and be in the business of the religious schools, observe, determine that they were spending the money only in this way and not in the other way, make sure that the curriculum was wholly secular and not inflected by the religious school's religious mission. And the court said, too much entanglement, right? The strict neutrality line of cases also includes Aguilar v. Felton, which is another school funding case. In this one, remedial services offered to students at religious schools were denied as a violation of the Establishment Clause because the secular teachers, the sort of state teachers, had to perform the services within the confines of the religious school. And again, the court felt like there was too much entanglement there. And finally, in Texas Monthly, a case that denied a state tax exemption that was targeted at religious periodicals. So it said you can't have a tax exemption that only applies to religious periodicals. This line of cases on the strict neutrality side runs, you know, roughly 1971 to 1989. And there's a similar line of cases that runs from 1970 to the late 80s on the benevolent neutrality side. Here, equal treatment of religions and religion and non-religion is not prohibited the support of government for religious activities, or at least not the support of secular activities conducted by religious organizations. Here you have the Waltz v. Tax Commission case, which upheld a property tax exemption for religious buildings used for religious purposes. You have the Mueller decision in which an income tax, state income tax deduction was granted to religious organizations. And you have Kendrick B. Bowen, which actually allowed some state funds to run to religious organizations. So this is the kind of background, right? This is neutrality in operation. Sometimes that neutrality comes out in more of a separationist vein. Sometimes it comes out in more of a benevolent neutrality vein. Following these line of cases, and beginning in the late 80s and then in the 90s, Justice O'Connor develops an approach that she refers to as endorsement. The endorsement approach, government may neither endorse nor disapprove of religion, right? So this sounds similar to the second prong of the Lemon test. But Justice O'Connor is really thinking about it in terms of the composition of a plural society. So in a plural society, can government go about its functions engaging with religious communities in a way that doesn't endorse the actions of those religious communities or disprove the actions of those religious communities? Endorsement allows for accommodations. It allows for government to offer some level of support to religious communities. But when that support becomes a factor in how people's political status is determined, then in accommodation becomes endorsement and there's a violation of the Establishment Clause. So this is fleshed out for O'Connor in a case called Mergens. In Mergens, the upheld the Equal Access Act that was passed by Congress, which essentially the Equal Access Act required public schools to provide space for religious non-curricular groups to conduct their meetings and their other activities. If the school conducted, or if the school allowed non-religious, non-curricular organizations, right? So if you have a scuba diving club and scuba diving is not part of the curriculum, then you have to allow the Christian organization to hold meetings in the public school. And essentially what O'Connor says in Mergens is the activities of the student organizations held on public school grounds can clearly be differentiated from the government itself, right? The activities of an organization in the public school is not government activity. There's an easy way to differentiate it, so it's not an endorsement of what the religious organizations are doing, right? And so it passes the endorsement test for O'Connor. Compare that with a case called Kiryas Joel, which is a case about a Orthodox Jewish community in New York that had a school district boundary drawn exactly on the borders of the Orthodox Jewish community. And the goal of this was for the state to provide remedial educational services to the community in a way that comported with the community's religious guidelines, including separation of genders. But in Kiryas Joel, the court held, and O'Connor used her endorsement analysis to join the opinion, that by drawing the boundaries exactly along the boundaries of a religious community, the religious community became a political community that was endorsed by the state. The state was saying, this religious community now has special political status, which is different from others, right? And so that's political status, right, which turns accommodation into endorsement and a violation of the Establishment Clause. There's a question, it's an open question, whether the endorsement test lives on past O'Connor's term on the court. Right? With O'Connor's retirement, it's not clear that the endorsement test will continue to show up in Establishment Clause jurisprudence. Justice Kennedy has developed his own kind of no coercion analysis. So for Justice Kennedy, the Establishment Clause's central concern is actually about coercion in religion. Is the government forcing people to believe, act, practice, engage religion in a way that they would not otherwise do? And so for Kennedy, the Establishment Clause isn't intended to remove religion from the public square. Kennedy is very happy for there to be religion in the public square, for different religious groups to kind of be vying with one another in public space, in the public square. But when the government steps in and requires or supports that activity in a way that people who would otherwise not participate are forced to participate, then you have an Establishment Clause violation. So a classic no coercion case from Kennedy is Lee v. Weissman, in which a Jewish rabbi was invited to give a graduation prayer at a middle school graduation. And the principal who invited the rabbi gave him a set of guidelines, said, you know, this is a public school, so you should not do this and you should do this in the context of your prayer. And Kennedy said, this is coercion on two fronts. One, while the students aren't required to attend the graduation, social pressure effectively makes it coercive, right? It's a middle school graduation. You want to go. Your friends are going to be there. Your parents want to see you graduate. And so it effectively coerces the students into participating in the prayer. Second of all, the principal has told the rabbi how he can and cannot pray. And so the principal has actually coerced the rabbi's prayer by setting guidelines and boundaries around it. So you have two different forms of coercion here from the government, both participation in religion and then coercion of religion itself. Equal access treatment is more of a Scalia and occasionally Thomas line of analysis. In equal access treatment, the idea is basically what it sounds like, right? Religious organizations should be given equal access when non-religious parties are receiving the same treatment. This line of analysis shows up most often in the equal access line of cases, which is cases asking whether religious group X can have access to the public forum, given that non-religious group Y has access to the public forum, and occasionally in the religious funding cases. Eventually, Scalia kind of distills his equal treatment analysis down into a two-pronged test, is the law religiously neutral on its face? And is the law religiously neutral in application, right? So does it target or specifically benefit religion as written? And then when it's applied, does it have the effect of benefiting or specifically targeting religion? Zelman v. Simmons-Harris is a good example of the equal access analysis. This is a school voucher case. So state law had allowed a limited school voucher program for parents of students in low-income communities who were students at low-performing schools. The voucher was given to them to attend another school, and the voucher could be used at a public school, a private school, or a private religious school. And Scalia said, yes, that's fine. It's equal access. Is the law religiously neutral on its face? Yes. The government is going to give you a voucher to use at the school of your choice, right? It's not a voucher to be used at a religious school. It's a voucher to be used at a school of your choice. Is it neutral in application? This is a little bit trickier, right? Because the actual facts of the case are that a lot of students went to religious schools. And so here the government seems to be funneling money to religious schools for religious education. But Scalia says, no, if you think about it, the government is giving the voucher to the parent, and the parent is choosing where they take their money. So that sort of two-step process intervenes. It's not religious funding, it's not government funding of religious education, it's government funding of parent choice, and parents can then decide how they want to use the money. So it is, in fact, religiously neutral in application. Another interesting line of analysis is history and tradition. This isn't so much a comprehensive Establishment Clause analysis, but it's an important factor that has played into some of the religious display and legislative prayer cases. On its own, history and tradition is not enough to defeat an Establishment Clause challenge, right? Just because something has been done for a long time does not mean that it comports with the Establishment Clause. But the fact that something has been done for a long time, has a long history and tradition, means that it has, you might say, a leg up in the analysis, right? If we've had legislative prayer since the First Continental Congress and we don't have an established church yet, then there's a good argument that legislative prayer doesn't threaten to establish religion in the US. So history and tradition becomes a component of the court's analysis, usually with one of these other factors, but for something that has been around for a long time, a practice that's been around for a long time, even though it may look like a government endorsement of religion, the history and tradition may help push it in the direction of surviving an Establishment Clause challenge. And then finally, in more recent cases, we've actually seen the revival of a strict neutrality and a benevolent neutrality approach, right? So you had O'Connor trying to get away from neutrality and the problems that emerge with neutrality being pulled back and forth. You have Kennedy trying to get away from it. You have Scalia trying to get away from it. But it does come back in a series of cases, a series of recent cases. The Lemon Test remains an aspect of the neutrality analysis. Sometimes the court will employ the Lemon Test in full. Sometimes the court will employ a prong of the Lemon Test. Sometimes the court will abandon the Lemon Test altogether. The Lemon Test remains used relatively heavily by lower courts because there's not a consistent, as you've seen, right, there's not a consistent analysis that the Supreme Court has pointed to and said, lower courts, do this when you have an Establishment Clause challenge. The Lemon Test is kind of the closest thing, even though the Supreme Court itself doesn't adhere to the Lemon Test in a consistent manner. But you will see it used often by lower courts because it's something they can grab onto and say, look, we've got three prongs. It's a relatively straightforward analysis. And so it gives us something to guide our decision making in these Establishment Clause cases. So now that we've had a brief tour of modern Establishment Clause jurisprudence, let's look at some of the places where religion and state meet and how those issues have been dealt with. So first of all, legislative prayer. So we have a couple of cases, Marsh v. Chambers and Town of Greece v. Galloway, where the court has upheld instances of legislative prayer in the Nebraska legislature in Marsh v. Chambers and in a local town council in Town of Greece v. Galloway. In both of these instances, the court relied heavily on history and tradition. As I said, kind of pointing to the Continental Congress and saying, look, they had legislative prayer at the Continental Congress. Many states have had legislative prayer over the years. Many municipalities have. Congress has. And so this history and tradition really makes it hard to argue that this threatens to establish religion in the United States. But not all legislative prayer is permissible, right? And I think Levy-Weissman is instructive here, even though it's not a legislative prayer case, right? This is a middle school graduation case. But what Levy-Weissman said is when prayer becomes coercive, then it becomes problematic. And I think that's probably a good guide for thinking about legislative prayer. So legislative prayers that are ecumenical, right? Open to people of all religious traditions to perform the prayer itself. It doesn't mean that you have to have a representative from lots of different traditions. Town of Greece v. Galloway, almost all of the prayers were performed by Christians because they couldn't find anyone of other faith traditions in the community. But it has to at least be open to the possibility of other people performing the prayers. Generally, the prayers don't have to be toned down, meaning you don't have to strip out your particular community's understanding of your religious tradition. But the more the prayer moves in the direction of exclusivity, the more problematic it becomes, right? So invoking the name of Jesus in your Christian prayer, probably fine. Invoking Jesus as the only path to salvation and then condemning lots of other religious traditions in the course of your prayer, probably not a good idea. The legislative prayer probably needs to be historical, right? If the city of Provo, assuming, for the sake of argument, doesn't currently have prayers at its town council and decided to have prayers at its town council tomorrow and someone challenged it immediately, it would be hard to make the history and tradition argument because it's not part of the history and tradition of this community, right? It might be part of the history and tradition of the broader nation, but history and tradition of the particular community also matters. And it has to be non-coercive, right? Part of what made Town of Greece v. Galloway okay in the court's opinion was the prayer was held at the very beginning of the city council meeting, not during substantive discussion. So people were welcome to come late or to step out of city council chambers while the prayer was being conducted. They didn't miss out on the proceedings of the city council meeting by not participating in the prayer. And we see that the court is really applying a benevolent neutrality and a historical analysis to this question. Religious displays. Now, there's a long line of religious display cases, so I'm not going to go through all of these for the sake of time. I'm going to talk just specifically about Van Orden v. Perry and McCreary County because they were decided in the same year in opposite directions, right? So in Van Orden v. Perry, the court held that a Ten Commandments display on I actually think that that's a typo. It shouldn't be courthouse. It should be legislative grounds. So it's a state legislature. The Ten Commandments display on the grounds of the legislature, along with lots of other monuments, and which had been there for 40 years, was upheld as not a violation of the Establishment Clause. And the court basically said, look, you've got history and tradition here. You've got non-coercion because it's on the grounds, which means you don't have to walk by it every time you go in to the government building, right? You can choose to go visit the statue of whoever on your way into the legislature instead of walking by the Ten Commandments. So it's not being forced on anyone. And it's also in a mix of monuments that celebrate religious influences, but also secular influences, lots of different kinds of memorials. It's just one, in a sense, among many. McCreary County v. ACLU, in contrast, was a Ten Commandments display that was posted inside of a courthouse immediately challenged, and then the county put up a bunch of other displays around it, also of a religious nature, which was then challenged. And then the county put up some religious and secular, did a big display of influences on law, which included secular and religious influences. And the court said, look, when you put the Ten Commandments up in the courthouse by itself in a prominent location, you are basically saying religion, this religious document, is really important. You should pay attention to it. We've got a coercion problem here because of its location in the courthouse. There's no history and tradition, right? It was newly placed, and it wasn't part of a broader set of materials. So you have these two religious display cases going in different directions, highlighting the fact that in sort of religious display, context matters, right? The history matters. How long has the display been there? The location matters. Is it something that people have to view when they want to conduct government business? This comes up in some of the Christmas display cases as well. So you have Christmas displays that are put in the courthouse that people have to pass by on their way to do government business, which is problematic. Displays out in a public park that people don't have to engage with, less problematic. And the environment matters, right? What is the what is the sort of environmental context? What other kinds of things are there with the religious display? So the Ten Commandments and the frieze of the Supreme Court, along with lots of other images of law in history, the court is not going to rip the Ten Commandments down from its own frieze, because part of it is that it's got a broader context, right? It's not an endorsement of a particular religious viewpoint, because the court is saying, look at all of these different influences that are part of our heritage. The context then indicates whether the display constitutes government speech or endorsement of religion, and also intent matters, right? So even though McCreary County put up a whole bunch of other stuff, changed the context, arguably so that it didn't on face endorse religion, the court still struck it down, saying, no, your intention, the sort of your cure was a sham. What you really wanted to do was make people think about the Ten Commandments as an influence on American history. You wanted them to engage that religious text, and all of this other stuff you put up as a litigation position, it's really just a sham. So the intent of the government action matters as well. Religious access to public space. This one's relatively straightforward. If you let secular groups use a public forum, then you need to let religious groups use a public forum. There are limitations on this, right? If the forum is not public, then religious groups don't have access by right, right? So if the public school doesn't let anybody use the school for any reason except curricular coursework, then a religious group can't make a claim that they're being discriminated against or they don't have equal access because no one has access. Also, the government can put constitutional time, manner, and place restrictions on that access, right? The school does not have to be opened up at midnight for a religious vigil because it would require staffing that the school district is not prepared to provide. Like, that's a reasonable time, manner, place restriction on access. And finally, government funding of religious organizations. So the trend in the government funding of religious organizations, particularly since Agostini v. Felton, is that the government will allow funding of religious organizations so long as that funding is for non-religious activity, for secular activity, and so long as I'll just flip over to my notes. Basically, government may fund secular activities as part of a generally available non-discriminatory funding scheme, right? So the government can't target religion and say, we're only giving money to Catholic family planning centers, right? Or we're only giving money to religious family planning centers. But if we're giving money to family planning centers generally, then giving money to Catholic family planning centers is fine. funding schemes that promote or subsidize religious activity, both directly and indirectly, generally fail the test of neutrality, right? So if you're giving money to a religious organization to hold worship services, then that's problematic. And the line here is a little fuzzy, right? So at what point does Trinity Lutheran, at what point does providing a grant to resurface your playground, which is used for religious education, free up money to be used for religious worship in the church that owns the playground? The court in Trinity Lutheran said, we haven't crossed the line here, it's fine, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second, but there is some fuzziness in the line between direct and indirect aid for religious activity. Finally, funding schemes that entangle government in the affairs of religious organizations are suspect, but not categorically prohibited. So if you remember the third element of the Lemon test, entanglement, right? That third element was actually stripped out in the Agostini case. Agostini kind of reduced the Lemon test to secular purpose and neither promotes nor disproves religion. It's not clear that whether that was limited to a school, a funding of materials for secular teaching in religious schools cases, or whether it applies more broadly. Trinity Lutheran not raising an establishment claim or an establishment problem in the majority opinion seems to indicate that entanglement is something that the court is not worrying about as much as it did in the 1970s and 80s. A final word on Trinity Lutheran. So as I said, Establishment Clause was not part of the majority opinion's analysis. They basically said both sides agree that the Establishment Clause would permit this type of funding, and we're not going to challenge that agreement between the parties. I think that there is probably an implicit agreement by the majority in Trinity Lutheran that there's not an Establishment Clause worry, because you're funding a secular activity, right? Playground resurfacing. Though, and this is will be probably too much detail, footnote 3 of Trinity Lutheran, which splits the court about whether it applies only to this specific kind of funding. So basically a public health benefit for kids, or whether it applies more broadly, raises some questions there. But Justice Sotomayor, in her dissent, takes the Establishment Clause question head on and basically says, look, this is a religious education program run by a church. You are funding the church to do religious education, even if you're repaving the playground. That's part of the educational experience. It's part of the mission of the church to provide this education. And that's an Establishment Clause problem, right? It is direct, for Sotomayor, it's direct funding of religious activity. Now, obviously, Sotomayor's dissent, joined by Ginsburg, does not carry the day in Trinity Lutheran, but I raise it because it's another reappearance of the strict neutrality standard, right? So Sotomayor is really invoking a strict neutrality standard here to say, whoa, like, we need some more distance here between the state and this church, or the state and religion more generally. So there's at least one, probably two voices on the current court that would continue a strict neutrality line of analysis. So what does separation of religion and state really mean? I think we can say that the Establishment Clause prohibits the government from endorsing or advancing religion. That much seems pretty clear. The Establishment Clause does not prohibit government from engaging with religious organizations, nor does it prohibit all public expression, religious expression in public spaces. Government should be neutral among religions and between religion and non-religion. I think these three things we can say for certain given the current state of the jurisprudence. Otherwise, it is the law professor's favorite answer to a law student's question and the law student's least favorite answer. It depends, right? There are several different forms of analysis that the court has recently taken, and those different forms of analysis can lead the court in different directions, generally vacillating between these two inherent tensions of separation and accommodation. If you'd like more reading in this area. The pamphlet you got on religious expression in American public life that was part of the conference materials is very helpful, very clear answers to a lot of these questions. I based most of this presentation on John Witte and Joel Nichols' Religion and the American Constitutional Experiment, which has a great history section, as well as addresses not only the Establishment Clause, but the Free Exercise Clause and international religious freedom in the, particularly the European Court of Human Rights now, and No Establishment of Religion, which is a series of essays on the historical founding treatment of the Establishment Clause, so how the Establishment Clause was seen at the founding and the kind of disputes over what establishment meant. And with that, we can open it up for questions. I ran a little longer than I'd hoped to, but I hope that we can have a good discussion. Yeah, so I think we're recording, so please wait for the mic. The gentleman here in the blue.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned Scalia and Thomas have their own little theory, but Scalia's gone. Mm-hmm. But so is Gorsuch going to go there or more towards Roberts or maybe Kennedy, more accommodationist?
Yeah, so we have Gorsuch.
Because he's been on the bench, but I don't know what he's written, really.
Yeah, I mean, what we know from, what we have from Gorsuch now is the Trinity Lutheran opinion. And generally, Gorsuch is a strong, say, a strong advocate of religious liberty, which I think we can read in an accommodationist vein, that Gorsuch's lower court opinions have generally been more on an accommodationist side. There are not a ton of establishment cases that come up in the lower court, so I don't know that we have a lot of data from his lower court opinions. We know that he joined the majority in Trinity Lutheran and used his concurring opinion to call into question a court precedent of Locke v. Davy. In the Locke v. Davy case, Washington State had a scholarship program. It denied a scholarship to someone specifically for the study of pastoral theology. They would allow the scholarship at religious schools, they would allow it for a study of religion, but they wouldn't allow it for specifically pastoral theology. And the court said the establishment, among other things in this case, the court said the Establishment Clause permits that, right? It permits Washington State to decide not to provide funding in this way, right? And which is in the background of the Trinity Lutheran case, because Missouri was saying, look, we've got these funds and we don't want to provide them in this way. And the majority opinion holds that that's not constitutional under the Free Exercise Clause. But Gorsuch uses his concurring opinion to at least call into question whether the Trinity Lutheran opinion should mean a revisiting of Locke. And if there were a revisiting of Locke, I think what Gorsuch is aiming at is a reading of the Establishment Clause that would not allow that kind of discrimination. So that's the best I can get on Gorsuch at this point. Yeah. I think the gentleman in the red tie in the back.
I don't know if you can go back to your concluding slide there.
Yeah. Do it over here.
I had a question about the third point. Government should be neutral among religions and between religion and non-religion. I think the first part of that is absolutely clear in the jurisprudence. But between religion and non-religion, I'm just not as familiar. Is that really based on the court's jurisprudence? Because it's very hard to take that position in our culture when our currency says in God we trust, and we have all these religious traditions that are accepted as part of our culture and our government, that the government has to be neutral when it comes. I mean, we see all these statements of the value of religion that was held by the founders and all these other things. Does the is that really based on jurisprudence? I honestly don't know.
So this is actually a refrain that you see in cases starting sort of with the Lemon Era and moving forward. And actually, I think that this language may go all the way back to Everson. And the court has this kind of refrain, neutrality between religions and between religion and non-religion. One way you can think about the neutrality between religion and non-religion would be to think about a program that was aimed only at religious communities. So if the government, so my family planning example, right? So the government assume that the legislature thinks that religious family planning is a lot more effective, right? For whatever reason, religious family planning centers do a much better job of assisting people with their family planning needs or whatever the goal is of the legislation. So the government writes a law that says, we're giving block grants out to religious family planning centers, but we're not gonna give them to secular family planning centers. That would violate the neutrality between religion and non-religion principle. The neutrality between religion and non-religion has not been read to require secularity. And that's, I think, how you can get some of the history and tradition arguments, right? It's how you can get the legislative prayer argument. It doesn't mean that we enforce a kind of French-style secularity as the norm of the state. But what it means is you can't treat non-religious groups who are asking for something worse or better than you treat religious groups that are asking for something. Was there another question over here on the left? No? Yeah, so in the back there. No, she's got you there.
Where are we headed with In God We Trust and One Nation Under God? Where's that going?
I don't think it's going anywhere. I think that the Marsh, Town of Greece, Van Orden line of cases say that the longstanding, and you know, if you read closely in those cases, part of the history and tradition argument is these things, because they are now part of the fabric of our social and civic history, the court doesn't necessarily read them as religious statements. They read them as sort of cultural statements of our social and civic life. And pragmatically, I think the court doesn't want to have that fight. It's hard for me to imagine the court granting cert on a case challenging In God We Trust on the money, because it's just not worth the court's time and the political capital that would go into that sort of challenge, for better or worse, depending on how you come out on that. Actually, this young woman up here first, and then I'll come and get these gentlemen.
First, I was wondering if you could go back to your slide with all the cases that you referenced. And then I was also wondering if you have a comment about tax exemptions and where you think that would go.
Yeah, so in Waltz v. Tax Commission, the court upheld property taxes for religious buildings. And I think Waltz is still good law. And I don't think there's any reason to question that religious property or religious tax exemptions generally will be upheld. I think there are two fronts for that. One, you have Waltz v. Tax Commission, which is strong precedent that the court consistently refers to in its later cases. So you've got strong precedent. Second of all, you have the neutrality principle, right? 501c3 nonprofit organizations have tax exemption. It would violate the principle of neutrality if 501c3 religious nonprofit organizations had their tax exemption stripped and non-religious 501c3s got to retain their tax exemption. So I don't think it comports with the principle of neutrality, and you've got case law on point. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Do you have a question?
Actually, I can do this more quickly. Yeah. There we go. Okay. The gentleman in the black. Yeah.
Yeah. Establishment clause jurisprudence is all over the board. That's compared to, say, free exercise clause jurisprudence. It makes it hard for a practitioner to predict mm-hmm. where things are going to go and how to advise on these kinds of things. Well, I'm going to ask a hard question. Where do you see it going? It seems like, you know, a good rule from the jurisprudence. We thought we had one with Lemon, and it's still the main one taught in law schools mm-hmm. and probably the main one you're going to use if you're practicing. And it's what the lower courts, I thought that was a really good observation, the lower courts are going to turn to Lemon every time because right. What else can they afford to turn to? they don't feel authorized to turn to any other test, even though the Supreme Court seems bent on finding other tests at different times mm-hmm. in the history of this jurisprudence. So, and yet Lemon seems unsatisfactory to a lot of people. I guess it's a speculative question, but where do you see it finally finding some kind of stability and equilibrium?
I don't. Would be my answer. I think that the tension between separation and accommodation is built into the Establishment Clause. And I think that it is, that tension itself is part of the heritage of the country, right? So there are people who feel very strongly that establishment means separation. There are people who feel very strongly that establishment means accommodation. And you see those views reflected in the court as well. Depending on how you think about it, pessimistic view would be that Establishment Clause jurisprudence is going to remain kind of a mess because there is this inbuilt tension of differing hermeneutic understandings, different ways of interpreting. Try Lemon because it's the most consistent. Neutrality is your best principle, I think, right? That's the most consistent principle to be invoked. I'm not a practitioner, so I don't give very much practical advice. But if you're trying to advise, I think looking at the principle of neutrality is the best advice that you can do. The gentleman here, and then I think the gentleman in blue had another question.
What about situations where a claim is made that the two religion clauses are in some inherent conflict with one another? Mm-hmm. Is that really just a false dilemma substantively? Or are there legitimate circumstances where the court has actually found a conflict? And if so, who trumps?
Yeah, that's an interesting and complicated question. So one view would be that there's not an inherent conflict between the two, and you can read the two consistently as promoting religious liberty, right? So you read the two consistently to kind of give religious people as much freedom as possible. That's one view. I think that's an ideal view. I think the way that free exercise jurisprudence and Establishment Clause jurisprudence have played out over time, you do get conflicts between the two. And there's not, I don't think that there is a trump for either one. What the court generally tries to do, this is what we saw in Locke v. Davy, they use this language of play in the joints. So there are things that the Establishment Clause permits that the Free Exercise Clause may forbid. There are things that the Establishment Clause forbids that the Free Exercise Clause may permit. If one of those clauses forbids something, it's probably going to be forbidden because we essentially have a regime of negative rights in the U.S., right? But if the Establishment Clause permits it, and the Free Exercise Clause doesn't forbid it, then you have this sort of zone where you can try and make the best situation of competition between the two.
Who had a question?
Just one more. The president was a John Jackson of that Sacramento College. The legislature down there, where I'm from, apparently is trying to pass a law to deny student funding because they believe in gay or against gay marriage and gay relations. But if that passed, wouldn't that challenge be against the separation clause because it inhibits or advances? Wouldn't that be a separation challenge?
So there may be a separation challenge there. When you get into the issue of sort of sexual liberty and religious liberty, and particularly because they're set up as a civil rights and a religious liberty challenge. And so you've got actually two constitutional provisions at issue. And so while there may be a separation claim that the government's refusal to provide funding violates the principle of neutrality, you can also imagine the argument being kind of flipped to say that if the government has a policy of equality and government is funding a religious school that's not comporting with principles of equality, then the government is supporting a kind of religious activity that's contrary to the government's position itself. And then you also have to ask the question about the Equal Protection Clause. and how a potential conflict between the Equal Protection Clause and the First Amendment might play out. And I'm not going to claim to know the answer to that question, but those are the kinds of issues that are at stake and makes it not a straightforward Establishment Clause question.
Yeah, all three of those. Well, maybe they'll pass the law. Yeah. We'll see the case.
Yeah. So I think we'll take the last one here, and then you all have a 15-minute break, I believe.
Thank you. Sort of tying in with that last question, would the doctrines around entitlements come into play if a legislature were to remove the tax exemptions for religious organizations or charitable organizations that are religious? Do you think that might have, you know, so many times with entitlements, if government gives it to you, it's hard to take it back away.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I don't know my entitlements, my sort of due process entitlements, learning may not be deep enough to answer that question. But I think it's probably moot because I don't think the tax exemptions are going anywhere on the basis of neutrality and WALTs, is the best answer I can give you. I mean, you'll have to get more of a broadly constitutional scholar to address the nuances of your question, which is unfortunately outside of my field. All right, thank you all very much for coming.